so. If we were on a flight right now and I were the captain, this would be the time when I say, ladies and gentlemen, we've now come to cruising altitude. You may unfasten your seatbelts and walk around the cabin. We've come to cruising altitude. We've had time to settle in. Jet lag should be pretty much finished by now for those traveling from afar. Getting used to kind of working out the kinks of what can be changed, what cannot, and recognizing what can't be changed in our rooms, the environment, and so forth. So I think it's really now we're ready to settle in, ready to have our second day of solitary retreat, you know, within the context of our community. Time to be settling in and kind of, I wouldn't quite say schedule, some people might like the word, some people not, but rhythm is a nice word. Time to kind of settle into the rhythm of, well, what would you really like to be doing here for these, you know, 6, 7 weeks or so? What kind of a rhythm of daily practice? Maybe include yoga, which is a marvelous idea, and then your formal practices, but also how do you really integrate your understanding of Dharma, your practice of Dharma, as much as you can 24/7. And what does that look like? How does that play out? And so just a very brief comments, because I'd like to get to this session quite quickly. I've mentioned to a few of you, but now I won't meet all of you one-on-one, so I'd like to share just a couple of thoughts with everyone. And that is, this is really kind of like an art form. We're not here as engineers, we're not here as technicians to, you know, just get the right format down and then plunk, 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 be really diligent workers. We're not on an assembly line here. But nor are we just kind of going freestyle, like, well, whatever I feel like doing. It's kind of like, if you're a Vidyadhara, then, you know, just do whatever you like. But if you're not quite there yet, then some balance between finding structure, rhythm, really seeing that you're making good use of your time here, good use in your own view. It's so some structure there, but also the flexibility, the time to really have the malleability, the freshness, that you're not getting into a rut. So it's the middle way there. Structure and malleability, structure and freshness. Having some core practices that you're really going deeper and deeper each day. At the same time, this morning, for example, we practiced Donglen. You may want to do that every day, but maybe not. Maybe you'd like to do it once in a while. You know. So that's what I'm suggesting here, is that you have your three basic food groups. I think I've mentioned that, not quite sure. But obviously shamatha every day. That's kind of just make the mind serviceable and more serviceable. We're here for largely for Vajra, for Vipassana and for Mahamudra. So the sooner we can bring in the wisdom element, the inside element, that certainly is one of the indispensable elements of meditative practice in the Buddhist tradition as a whole. And that includes contemplative reading. And then, of course, there's the heart, whether it's the four measurables, it's refuge, it's bodhicitta, guru yoga, sadhana practice. A number of you have daily commitments, as do I. They're your three basic food groups, you know? And so then you find, okay, within that, I think that's pretty encompassing. Within that, then just from day to day, see that you're there. Always a little bit of gasoline left in your tank at the end of the day, that is not having push so hard you just feel drained and exhausted at the end of a session or the end of the day. Having that freshness. And if I give you one sign of success, because I've lived with yogis who are really professional. I mean, they, you know, there's simply yogis, like some people are carpenters and architects and cooks. There are people I know who are simply yogis. That's what they do for the whole life. And, you know, they're just, they're not, they're just, you know, I've lived with them, and they're not thinking, oh, how many years do I have to practice for this, and when I'm going to achieve that, and they're just, this is what I do. Genlam Rinpoche, when he's coming towards the end of his life, you know, and he knew he had cancer, he knew he was dying of cancer, decided not to go with the chemo and so forth, no, I'm finished, ready to go. Went back to his meditation hut in Sikkim, a friend of mine was with him, and here's this old yogi, you know, old yogi, a little bit older than I am right now when he passed away. And his meditation practice was from 5 o'clock in the morning, kind of a slacker, yeah, because I often start earlier than that myself. Oh, except for, oh yeah, until 1 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, 5 o'clock in the morning till 1 o'clock in the morning. Then, oh, they shut my mouth. That's it. But you know, that's just what he did. You know, so that kind of that sense of here, for the next 7 weeks, we're just here as contemplatives, and establish that rhythm and say, you know, I'm sure he died without regret. And then whatever, however fast it unfolds, that's how fast it unfolds. So for this session, I'd like to have a silent session. We're coming to the end of this week. And so final group session before we have our one day of solitary practice. And what I'd like to suggest is you do focus on shamatha, that you focus on mindfulness of breathing, and that you just explore yourself. Then you choose. Just like choosing what you have for breakfast. If you're at home, you choose what you have for breakfast. Then whether it's full body, phase one, up and down abdomen, phase two, nostrils, phase three, or the subtlest, but which segues most smoothly into the Mahamudra and the Dzogchen, and that is that resting in awareness with just a peripheral awareness. Just kind of keeping, almost like putting your little pinky, just the pinky on the breath. Just enough that you know when it's going in and out. Gives you kind of like something to hold on to. Like little kids, like when they're learning how to swim, they can be above, in water deeper than their bodies, so they would really, but they have something to hold on to, like that. It's one of those styrofoam things. So they're mostly swimming and they're paddling, but they got something to hold on to, like that. So that something to hold on to, of course, is your breath. And then when you don't need it, when you feel, hey, I float by myself, then release it. Free fall with no falling. Good. So you choose. And also in one session, you can do one for some time and move ahead. If you find you're kind of, the gears are not meshing, you're kind of spinning your wheels kind of like just like that, then backshift, downshift. Go to something a bit more, something you can really engage with better. Yeah? So find yourself. See you in 24 minutes. So just one or two comments, kind of finishing comments on the mindfulness of breathing practice. In the kind of the oral tradition in Tibetan Buddhism regarding settling body, speech and mind in the natural state. I think this comes from Padmasambhava. I think so. It says when you're really settled your respiration, nilubhava, in its natural state, the breathing becomes imperceptible. That is, you can't hear it. Right? So that is definitely said. I would add a bit of commentary that when it's really settled, again, like kind of cruising altitude, it's worked out the turbulence sometimes, again, in the earlier phases. Sometimes it's long, it's short, there are pauses after the out-breath, perhaps, kind of going through the turbulence of kind of just working itself out, working the kinks out, And then after some time, it's bound to happen that you settle in. And then you find this nice sinusoidal, just kind of like nice, smooth, very just ongoing, nice rhythm, gentle rhythm, very soft, very gentle, and silent. And my hypothesis is that it's 15 cycles per minute. Test it. I didn't make up the number. I think there's probably something to it. Especially when I saw that that's what happens in deep sleep. But I was actually pretty confident before then. And so that's the point I would suggest. This is now interpretation. That's the point. When you settle into that flow of breathing, it's shallow, it's soft, it's gentle, continuous. I would suggest that it's at that point that the Buddhist teachings, breathing in, I tend to the whole body. Breathing, attending to the whole body, I breathe in. Attending to the whole body, I breathe out. And you can, again, read that either way, attending to the sensation throughout the entire body, or the Theravada interpretation is very good. And that is, you're just there. So like, they often speak of the rider and the mount. This is Dujum Lingpa. This is Padmasambhava. And it's classic. And the rider and the mount. The rider and the mount means horse. And so just the two going together. Just like, you know, when a rider is just kind of melts with a horse, and you're just kind of like, they seem like one entity, like almost like a centaur, you know, like one entity. You just feel, boy, they're just so connected. They're so connected. And again, I'll mention that movie, Buck, where you see just the incredible empathy, this just the intimacy, there's the word, the intimacy of the horse and the rider when they really have this deep friendship. I think that's the best word for it. So, but I'm getting back here, just that you're just right there. Your awareness, just riding, smoothly riding, and not getting dropped off, not stumbling, not going up to the air, and so forth. And so when that happens, that's when you're in that flow. Then, again, attending the whole body. You're just there continuously. You're in flow. So if you're a marathon runner, this is where you've got your second breath and your second wind, and now you're just there. Because you're going to be in that flow, in that cruising altitude for the rest of the marathon, right? Something like that. And then we'll find the fourth phrase, or item in this 16 phase of, you know, mindfulness of breathing, with the final 12 being on Vipassana. The final one of the four, culminating in Shamatha, is calming the system of the body I breathe in, calming the system of the body I breathe out. So that's where, when you're in that mode, the whole body-mind system, the body explicitly, the body-mind, integrated system. The whole body-mind system is really just calming down, calming, calming, calming. That's the meaning of Shamatha. Calm abiding, calm resting, quiescence, serenity, tranquility. And so then it's quite clear, the hypothesis here is very, very strong, that the amount of breath you're taking in is just getting less and less. The whole system is calming down, coming to equipoise. And it's said in the Theravada tradition, the Pali Canon, the Tibetan tradition, and the Theravada tradition, that you achieve the perfection of mindfulness when you come to the fourth jhana. That now mindfulness is just, it's maxed out. And it's that point that it's said universally, Chinese Buddhism, Theravada, Indian Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, they will say this, we know. I could be here as spokesman, you know, like we're having a press conference, and I'm speaking for the Buddhist community, and this is going to pertain to what I'm later comments. We know with certainty that when you achieve the fourth jhana, breathing stops entirely, and it can remain stopped for hours or even days on end with no damage to the body whatsoever. This we know. Press conference is over. Thank you very much. That is, we have nothing to discuss. If you want to disagree, you're very welcome, but frankly, you don't know what you're talking about, so I'm not really interested in what you have to say. So that's mindfulness of breathing. It'd be very cool if somebody achieved the fourth jhana. I'm not going to even try, but you know, people have a lot of time on their hands. It would be very interesting to achieve that and have it inspected from outside. So, just before, I forgot my book. Maybe somebody can lend me yours. Thank you. Only one will do. Thank you. Yeah, we're going to get to it very shortly, but very relevant to what we're about to read. I'd like to ask, first of all, does anybody here in the room, do any of you not know what country you're born in? Anybody not know? Okay, let the record show, people listening by podcast, no hands went up. Not a surprise, that's why I didn't ask, you know, 50 hands to go up, not a surprise. So now here's the second question, and that is, the European Union spent something like $7 billion or euros, I can't remember which, but a lot of money, creating this Large Hadron Super Collider with about 3,000 world-class engineers, scientists, mathematicians working. And one of the major rationale for spending that much of money, which the Americans couldn't afford, you know, European, but America, we tried and they just wouldn't pay for it. But the Europeans had more money and they did this. And one of the major reasons for building this, they really wanted to put to the test to see whether the hypothesis of this Higgs boson, you know, the God particle, the particle that gives mass to all other particles in the universe, whether it actually exists. It was predicted, in the 1960s, I think, by the Scottish physicist Higgs. But they didn't have any empirical evidence because you need a really, really high energy particle accelerator to be able to even put it to the test. So does anybody know whether they actually discovered the Higgs boson, or is that still just purely hypothetical? Anybody know? You know? Yeah? You know, don't you? Did they succeed or not? You know?
Well, it depends. Define discovery.
Say again?
Define discovery.
Well, what did they say?
Well, they said that there's a likelihood that...
They're very cautious. They're very cautious, yeah. They're very, very cautious. He did get a Nobel Prize after all, though. So that would suggest they're pretty confident, because you don't see it. We're giving you a Nobel Prize for a maybe. You know? Maybe that was too tough a question. How many of you know that the atomic structure of water is H2O? Okay, that was easier, yeah. You were very cautious. I appreciate that. Okay, that's good. That's good. You see, I've rehearsed this. How many know it's in my hand? Let the record show no one knows it except I do. No one knows, okay? I have taken the five upasaka vows, including I don't lie. But I really try not. I'd have a vow not to lie. I'm going to tell you with that background that I have the five upasaka vows, precepts, lay precepts. One of those is don't lie, intentionally. I'm holding lip balm, a little stick of lip balm in my hand, right? How many of you know what I'm holding in my hand? Not all the hands go up. Some are, But let the record show some hands went up, another one is, a quizzical look in the eye, because they know I joke around a lot, okay? How many know what I was holding in my hand? Some hands are still down. Lip balm. Plain Puget Sound. Yep, university, they gave me this. I gave a lecture there, and they gave me, I don't know why. They gave me lip balm. But they did. How many know what I'm holding in my hand? Oh, come on, give me a break. What more do you need? Some hands, I'm smearing this stuff on my lips, and some people are still not putting their hands up. I want to see a hand. You need to try it yourself. Come on. Well, I got some really hard cases here, Pete. You know. Okay, there was a reason behind the madness. When we say, as I would say, and we do say, and I do not challenge the statement, I know where I was born. How on earth do I know I was born? It was a hospital room, but I can't even remember that. I could have been born on a haystack. I could have been born in Uruguay. How do I know? My parents said so, yeah, but you know. I could have been adopted. They just didn't want to tell me. That has happened, right? So how do I know? And I will say, and now I'm speaking Buddhist epistemology, do I know where I was born? Yes, how do I know? Do I remember seeing the place? Do I remember interviewing the people? Are we in fact in California? Is this Pasadena? Is this in fact Huntington Hospital in California? I can't read yet, but could you please read that for me? You know, the answer is no, I don't actually have any empirical evidence to that effect at all. None. No. Well, how about cogent logic? Do I have some really sharp evidence that I can infer definitely? Answer is no, I don't. I'm not even sure I've ever seen my birth certificate. I don't have it. So no, it's not empirical knowledge. I haven't seen it. It's not syllogism. It's not an inference. I can't give you any inference. My mommy said, what's that? That's pretty much what it is. My parents said, but that's really not an inference at all. I just told you who told me. But we do say, as we, every hand stayed down when I said, you know, if you do not know, everybody, so everybody's saying, yes, I know. This is a type of, it is called inference, but it's inference based on authority. It's a difference with belief. Now, if I'd asked, I won't do it now it's too late, and I don't have anything else to put in my hand. I got a pen, and that just sticks out at both ends, it doesn't work. But I could have asked, and I should have actually, when I was holding that unknown entity in my hand and I'm telling, it's lip balm inside. How many of you believe me? I think more hands would have gone up. I just told you I have to have the vow and so forth. I think more hands would have gone up. How many, but you say, well, no, I don't know. But then you see there it was. And so how, believe me, probably most hands would go up. Probably not Lena, because she's a tough nut to crack. I saw her hands staying down. So there's a difference. This is interesting, and it pertains directly where we're going. This is why I'm spending some time here. There's a difference between belief and inference based on authority. Belief is, frankly, it's cheap. It's cheap. Just somebody says something, and you say, well, I believe you. You know, some stranger walks in and said, hey, I just saw a falling star. I just saw a shooting star. Cool. Okay, yeah, I believe you. Why not? What's it going to cost me? Right? A stranger walks in and said, hey, folks, wake up. I saw a UFO. Total stranger just walks in. Hey, everybody, I just saw a UFO. It's gone now. You can't see it. But do you believe him or not? Well, you either do or you don't, but it's just belief. It's just belief. It's not knowledge. But when we say, I know where I was born, I know who told me. I have good reason to believe that my mother gave birth to me, that my father is my father. I think very good reason to believe. There's no reason they would possibly deceive me. I can't imagine why they would tell me I was born in California when I wasn't. They do know where I was born. And so they are authorities on my birthplace, my parents, as your parents are. They're authorities. And you know they're authorities. It's not blind faith. It's not a leap of faith at all. It's you know their authorities. You know they have no reason to deceive you. And therefore, all of your hands stay down. That's inference. But that's because you know who said it, and you have very good reason beyond all reasonable doubt. Use courtroom terminology. Beyond all reasonable doubt. And none of you are doubting. These people know where you're born, and they told you veridically where you were born. And this is now part of your knowledge repertoire, right? So I took an easy one, but it is something every single person here said, I know where I was born. Yeah. And yet, if we're really tough and say, show me the empirical evidence, show me the reasoning, I don't think any of you could come up with it. Birth certificate, they're forged all the time. What's a piece of paper? That doesn't prove anything. Forgeries are really good forgeries out there, right? And so we'll see then that this type of inference is not that easy. That you don't give it out like party favors. You don't just kind of give out that type of confidence. And so you see where I'm going briefly. I'm not going to belabor the point. But when we have this happen frequently, people who have very high reputation in the scientific community, like the reporter, when the scientific community got up, those working on the Human Genome Project, and one, probably a small group of people who are the kind of the shining lights and are very articulate, have good stage presence, they got up and announced, we have now completed, what, for the most part, what, 97%, something like that. We have now mapped the human genome, okay? Or we have discovered this, or we have discovered 20 or 25 years ago, we have now discovered very compelling evidence that there are, in fact, exoplanets, circulating or going around other stars. And now it's hundreds and hundreds, right? And so they will say, we now know. And then they share that with the general public. And those of us who appreciate science, who've studied it somewhat, who have an appreciation of the stature, the well-earned stature, of Cambridge University, MIT, Harvard, the Sorbonne, University of Tokyo, University of Berlin, and so forth and so on, you know, the top flight world-class universities and the scientific institutions within them, that advanced study at Princeton and so forth, Caltech and so forth. When people coming from such communities say, we've discovered such and such a particle, we know beyond a shadow of a doubt exactly what the speed of light is in a vacuum. How many of them have actually measured that? It's a minute percentage, because why on earth would they? When somebody else has done it so well, why would they think, oh, I better take some time out of my busy schedule. Maybe they're all wrong. I should probably, oh, come on, you know. Nobody's gotten that much time to kill. But they will say, we know with tremendous precision the speed of light in a vacuum. We know with tremendous precision that the inverse square law of gravity is in fact inverse square law and not that plus a little bit, and so forth. The universal constant and so on. We know, we know, we know, and it is knowing. But almost all of the, I think it's probably 99%, you know, taking a number out of a hat, almost all that the scientific community knows, when any individual says we know, 99% of what they know is by authority. And that's the way it should be. Science is too large, too complicated, too specialized for anybody to go around from discipline to discipline to discipline. You know, do we know, you know, do we know what's behind polio? Do we know what TB is about? Do we really know what causes TB? Well, yes, we do. How many people do? Tiny fraction, and that's enough. Yes, the scientific community knows. 99.9% of the scientific community has no evidence or compelling reasoning what's behind tuberculosis, but they know there are people who die. So this is common, and this is how science progresses. And it has been progressing for the last 400 years. A few people have the empirical evidence. It's a tiny fraction. And they need to demonstrate that to their peers, and then it gets published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, a good one, preferably. And then others know it by inference. And then the vast majority have knowledge based upon inference of authority, right? And that is the greatest success story on the planet in terms of consensual knowledge. That's accepted all over in communist countries, Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, and so forth and so on. The greatest success story in human history is the last 400 years of the growth of science. And I say that only with admiration and appreciation. So when I say most of their knowledge of the community, or we as the general population, that our knowledge of the solar system and H2O and so forth and so on, that when I say that this is inference based on authority, that's in no way deprecating, it's just true. It's just true. And we watch the news. I read science columns every day. I'm getting a lot of articles from scientific journals. Friends all over the world send me. And my knowledge is growing in that way. But it's more than simply belief. But that means you need to know something about science, that if they're not just coming up with speculations. You have to have some appreciation for scientific method, the rigor, the precision, the peer review, which is enormously important, and knowing some scientists here and there are fudging the data, are lying, deceiving, and so forth, but they're a minority, and they have that peer review, and they keep on correcting it when it happens. So it's really still working. Now, there are areas that are more questionable, but I won't go into those right now. I just want to highlight this. Now, let's jump out of science. Is that the only community that's had a great success story of coming up with consensual knowledge that the community as a whole knows, even though it's only a tiny minority of those in the community who actually have direct empirical knowledge and actually really know by direct experience, by observation, by measurement, or by very close inference, like mathematical inference? That's how they know about exoplanets, of course. Nobody's ever seen one. It's by inference, mathematical inference. But it's very sharp mathematical inference based upon extremely precise measurements. So do I know that there are exoplanets? Yeah, I do. And you know exactly what I mean by that. I don't have a clue what the mathematics are. I don't know what the evidence is. But I've got a lot of confidence in these people, and it's well-earned confidence. So now we can ask, all right, is there any other community? And we're going to see a lot of citations coming up here. And they're going to be from the Albert Einsteins, the Niels Bohrs, the James Clerk Maxwell, the Newtons and the Galileos of the Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist tradition for the last 1,200 years, and going back earlier than that. To think that Eurocentric civilization has a monopoly on genius is just bullshit. And we act that way a lot. An awful lot, embarrassingly so. I mean, it's sheer racism. I mean, let's be really blunt about this. It's just flat-out racism. And a lot of what comes under the guise of secular Buddhism, frankly, I think is thinly veiled racism. Let's not take what they say. If they're just beliefs, what do they know after all? We white guys will get in here, and we'll just practice, and we'll take everything they say as mere hypotheses, but we're not going to believe what they said. What are we, jackasses? No, you're a racist. That's what you are. So is this simply a belief system? If the Buddha said, get my creed down, get an A, score 100% on the test, and you get a free ticket to liberation, then yes, this would be a system of dogma for the last 2,500 years. Just get the right answers. believe the right things, say I do at the right times. But the Buddha never suggested that, and even remotely. This is a wisdom tradition. If it's not a knowledge tradition, this is bullshit. A lot of people want to kind of have it both ways. Buddha's really a nice guy, but of course don't believe what he said. Now, he's either psychotic or he's enlightened, but there's really not much in between. Because he said, I saw with direct knowledge my past lives, other people's lives, the loss of karma, the 12 links of reincarnation. I know this is my last life. You believe that or you don't? If you don't, that's fine. I have no objection at all. But let's not pretend that there's some middle way there. Don't believe anything we said. Don't believe anything he said, after all. You know. What does he know? But oh, I'm a Buddhist. Yeah, right. Bullshit. So let's read a little bit and see what they're saying about Avalokiteshvara practice. And who are they? And are we believing? Are we having faith? Are we having skepticism? Or as we read this, if we affirm it, do we actually have inference based upon authority? So, oh, yeah. So here we are on page 43. The Tantra of the Lotus King, the Tantra. So you remember? Suffering stops simply by hearing of the characteristics of the body, of the protector of Avalokiteshvara, and one is led to bliss with mindfulness and veneration. And then it goes, so now we're getting very specific. So it's a tantra, it goes back to India, attributed to the Buddha. When saying that, again, it's in many cases, not suggesting that historical Buddha actually said it, in many cases it's a pure vision of one of the great Mahasiddhas, having a direct vision of Vajrapani or one of the other emanations, archetypal forms of the Buddha, receiving teachings, which are really, to use the Western term, Gnostic teachings, because they are having direct teachings from the Buddha after the Parinivada of the Buddha, but this is Dhammakaya taking on form, and they're getting Buddha teachings hundreds of years after the Buddha's passed away. It's flat-out Buddhist Gnosticism. That's what Duchum Lingpo is receiving. He's receiving teachings from a Buddha in his pure vision. And where this moves beyond simply belief, which is not a bad thing. I mean, we believe all kinds of stuff. All of us do. But what really makes, I'm just going to skip out of this just momentarily, but with Duchum Lingpa, I mean, his claims were frankly, even in Tibet, kind of outlandish. Because most of the great lamas who had visions, they also, you know, their teacher was a Karmapa, it was a Kenzei Rinpoche, it was a, you know, they had great teachers and they were identified as tulkus, so they would start having visions of Tara, of Manjushri, of Vajrapani, and so forth. Well, yeah, you're the seventh incarnation of this great Mahasiddha, and so forth and so on. So kind of like, okay, within that peer review, you know. So if children like Tsongkhapa went well into his years, when he was having direct visions of Manjushri, and when he had tough problems that Tsongkhapa couldn't figure out. Grappling with Madhyamaka, and had gnarly points in Madhyamaka that Tsongkhapa was having a hard time dealing with. I can't even, well, I've read it, but well, then he would just ask Manjushri. And Manjushri would, he would have a question and answer session with Manjushri. That would clear things up for Tsongkhapa. And then his question and answer session with Manjushri made its way into his collected works. Oh, by the way, when I check with Manjushri, this is what he said. Well, again, this can sound like total, you know, la-di-da, fanciful, except that Tsongkhapa was a brilliant teacher, and you look at his disciples and the lineage since then, you see how many achieve extraordinary states of realization. Manifesting that. You say, wow, maybe we should start taking that seriously. Duchum Lingpa, he was odd. Because he was not recognized as a tulku as a child, just a nomad kid. You know, like somebody born out in Alice Springs. Imagine some little Aussie kid saying, hey, mommy. I can't mimic the Australian accent. But hey, mommy, mate. I just had a vision of Manjushri and he gave me some teachings. How many of you can take that little kid seriously? You know? That's pretty much it. Just a nomad kid. Age 2, oh, I had a vision of Mandarabha, Yeshitsogya, Padmasambhava. Oh, then I had such a Saraha, and I saw Padmasambhava, and I just, not Padmasambhava, yeah, Padmasambhava, and I saw Nagarjuna, and I saw Avalokiteshvara and Vajrapani, and they all gave me these teachings. you know, it was suspect. And a lot of the great lamas, bear in mind, there's infrastructure here, just like the Western University system. That's infrastructure. That's peer review. And for quite a number of years, they just said, oh, nice kid. Run along, run along. Take Manjushri and Padmasambhava with you. Because he didn't have any teacher at all. He's just a little kid that's saying he's had all these visions. And then he gets a bit older, he starts writing. But the real clincher was when he started teaching, and then his students started realizing Rigpa. And his students started manifesting rainbow body. Now that's evidence. You see, as soon as you see that, like it's like Jeffrey Hopkins evaluating the Prajnaparamita Sutra. When you understand it, who else but a Buddha could have taught that? If you've got a teacher and 13 of his disciples achieve rainbow body and they're manifesting that, their bodies dissolving into light, leaving hair and nails behind, you might want to go and review that, what he was saying when he was a kid, because it's probably not just some kid making up stuff. Because the proof is in the pudding. And there's a quote I might share with you that my Vesna just sent it to me at a big conference. It was a Western Teachers Conference in Dharamsala, I think. I don't know exactly when it took place. But His Holiness was saying, I'm going to paraphrase, and I will send it, so you'll see what I'm trying to say, speak accurately. He said, there's really only one important criterion of a Buddhist teacher. And that is not how many titles you have, not how much realization you're said to have, not whether you're a tulku, you're a Rinpoche, you're a Geshe, a Kempo, or anything like this. This is a paraphrase, but this is right on the point he's making. It's none of that. How highly you regard, it's none of that. The only criterion that really matters is if you're a Buddhist teacher is, what's the benefit for your students? The rest is secondary. How are your students turning out? That was very pragmatic, right? I'll send you the exact quote, then you can see how well I paraphrased it. I'll send it to Doug and to Sange. So people listening by podcast, that's coming up. And just my, again, for people podcast and here, what I'm going to do now, starting tonight when the talk is over, I'm going to update my notes, all those quotes from Clifford and from Einstein and so forth. I've already put it in. This one from His Holiness, I'll put in. And so every Saturday evening, I'll update them. So you just get a newer your version. I'm adding to the older, okay? Then you'll have access to every quote I'm giving, okay? So back to this. We have claims here. And these are classic religious claims. I mean, these are not philosophical claims. They're not empirical, you know, Buddhist scientific claims. These are religious claims. There's no question about it. We can believe them or not. And it may be simply belief, but if you do put in the hard work, you can go beyond belief as you're reading these to an inference based upon authority. You have to earn that one. That's hard work. That's study. It's practice. It's investigation. It's appreciation. It's really getting to know. Like a scientist who really spent years and years studying science. When the scientist says, we know this, it's not just belief. They've worked too hard for that to be merely belief. So let's read a bit more. So again from this Tantra of the Lotus King. And so now going right to Avalokiteshvara. Among all his four hands, and so we have this lovely illustration just above me of the tanka. Among all his four hands, his forearm Chenrezi, the palms of the first are pressed together at the heart. He is white, radiating a blue sheen, the purest of all colors. His vast purity is known to all. By meditating while bearing him in mind, the obscurations of sins or vices of immediate retribution, you know the five, they are purified. In relation to yourself and others, cherish his mandala alone. Many thoughts and appearances are purified. If done well, this alone suffices. So, strong statement. Then we have a statement from, now in this text it's called Orgyen Rinpoche. It just almost about, I think almost always refers to him as Orgyen Rinpoche, Padmasambhava. Okay. And he states, by actualizing the great compassionate one, all the sugatas are actualized. We just can't help being reminded of a statement by Atisha. When he saw what the Tibetans were doing, And he spent, 13 years or so in Tibet, I think, something like that. But he was this incredible pundit, of India, one of the greatest of his time, maybe the greatest of his time. And so he knew how Indians practiced Buddhism. This was really quite during its apex, 11th century or so. And then he was in Tibet, and with the Tibetans for those final years of his life. He said, "You Tibetans, you meditate on 100 deities and you don't realize even one. We Indians, we meditate on one and we realize 100. If that was true 1,000 years ago, I think, it's still true. Except for now he can say, "You are sinners." Yeah. Oh, never mind. I mean, that's what he would say. Well, I was going to say something, but never mind. I don't want to make you feel discouraged. Especially you, Alan. You're talking to me? So, Kadasa. So, realize Avalokiteshvara, realizing one Buddha, if you realize them all. Sugatas are those who have gone to bliss, the bliss of enlightenment. In the section on the assembly of four deities, the Kadam volume praises Avalokiteshvara. So now from the Kadampa tradition, tracing back to Atisha. The serene, compassionate one is without compare. His bounty of compassion is incalculable. That is the essential nature of Avalokiteshvara. And from the same text, he is the palace of all the jhanas and their children, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. In a single pore, incalculable realms of jhanas are gloriously displayed. Same text. If well examined, it is like this. He alone is the mandala of all the Buddhas, of the four embodiments, Dhammakaya, Sambhogakaya, Manakaya, you're familiar, and Svabhavakaya, and the assemblies of peaceful and wrathful Viras and Viras. Viras or Dakinis and Viras, you know. The king of the Tantra of the Lotus King again says, "The Lord," referring to the Buddha, of course, this states, "This is meditation on the one mandala of the body of all the Buddhas of the three times. The synthesis of all the Buddhas is the body of the protector of Avalokiteshvara. Simply by recalling him, all thoughts of the cycle of existence are stopped, and the entire essence of all nirvana well emerges." The Holy Dharma, the White Lotus Sutra, Pundarika Sutra. Recall with no doubts the pure being Avalokiteshvara. When you are dying and when you are assaulted by mental afflictions, he will be a pure protector, refuge, and friend. Back to Kamachame. But you see, he had very little to say. He's mostly simply adding one more flower to another to his bouquet. In terms of mantras, there are none that have benefits comparable to those of the six syllables. Of course, Om Mani Padme Hum. The Tantra of the Lotus King states, the Lord said, "Free of doubts, apply yourself to this, which is the condensed essence of all the Buddhas of the three times. If you reverently utter one time, Om Mani Padme Hum, which is like a jewel in the ocean," and that's referring to a wish-fulfilling jewel in the ocean, "sentient beings will be freed from the malady of the hells. By uttering it twice, the door to the realm of pretas is closed. Reciting it three times closes off the realms of animals. Even while indulging in the five sensual pleasures, one who is not separated from this remains pure. By recalling these syllables, there is no fault in one's food, clothing, or drink. This is like taking the essential kernel from inside a husk of rice. It is like taking a flower from a wish-fulfilling tree. Gods, Nagas, Yakshas, Gandharvas, the fire god Yama, Brahma, Indra, Kumbhanda, and all the outer and inner malevolent beings are pacified by the recitation of the King of Mantras. Its excellent qualities are beyond reckoning, for the Aryas alone can calculate them." So it's a very strong praise. The 108 names of Avalokiteshvara states, the Lord said, "If a son or daughter of good breeding," simply a son or daughter of the family, "brings Ari Avalokiteshvara to mind and recites Om Mani Padme Hum, that person will not be born in a miserable state of existence and will not go to Avicii. Those who recite or chant upon rising in the morning will be freed from leprosy, abscesses, rashes, boils, skin diseases, idiocy," not sure about idiocy, might want to check that one, "respiratory diseases, and all other illnesses." Okay? And I have to say it. The owner of this book said, "Really?" And that's a really good response. That's a really good response. The really bad response would be, and not chew at all. This reminds me of the Metta Sutta. Now a lot of people would say, what on earth, who wrote that text? You know, like 108, who wrote that text? And where did they come up with this? You know, Domdumba, for example, the great disciple of Atisha, died of leprosy. And he was regarded as a previous incarnation of His Holiness Dalai Lama. In the Metta Sutta, now we're back to Pali Canon. In the Metta Sutta, the Buddha speaks of, oh no, it's not the Metta Sutta, but it's one of the Buddha's discourse in the Pali Canon. He lists, some of you will recall, 11 benefits of meditating, cultivating loving kindness. 11 benefits. Remember? One of them is, you'll not be harmed by fire, poison, things like that. That's the Buddha. That's pretty clearly the Buddha. It's Pali Canon, it's the Nikayas. Theravada, it's the teachings of the Buddha that are just pretty widely accepted in all schools. Yeah, the Buddha really said this. And there he said it. I don't have the exact quote, but it's kind of like, what? And when I'm teaching that, I said, don't try this at home. You know. So I won't try to defend or to refute. I will say this, though. If you're just saying Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, like you're reading a telephone book, then I would say this is unequivocally false. We just wouldn't need any medicine at all. Just people come to the hospital, say just here, recite Om Mani Padme Hum and pay your bill. You know, in America, you know, pay up. You know, Om Mani Padme Hum, pay up. That would be it. You know, that would be just, you know, panacea. That would be it for everything. If it can cure leprosy, etc., well, then why not cancer and tumors and etc., etc., all kinds of things. So the mantra itself, I don't think so. What about if that mantra is accompanied with very powerful samadhi, great purity of mind, and very deep faith? What then? To be investigated. I'm not here to convert people, I'm not convincing them, believe me, I'm not here to do that. We're here to investigate. That's what the Buddha encouraged, you know. See something like that, and that's the right response. Really? She didn't write nonsense, or you got to be kidding. That would be fine too. I don't mind. I'm not going to be upset. But it was just, really? That's, I think, the really best response. Really? Under what circumstances? Is that ever true? Is it true sometimes? If so, what times? What times is it not? Dum dum. That's the time it's not. That's interesting. I think to be investigated. Just leave it at that. Why not just leave it wide open? To be investigated. For myself, that's my response. I don't write it off. I don't say, oh, that's just religious hodgepodge, mumbo-jumbo, and so forth. I don't do that. This Kamachame, he was nobody's fool. He was the one that chose that. He's nobody's fool. He was brilliant. He was a great adept, an accomplished master. And he chose to include this. So, all right, we're talking about peer review here. Talking about peer review. He's right up there with the people he cites. People are citing him as he's reciting those who came before him. Does that mean infallibility? Does it mean that everything he's writing is literally true in every circumstance? Of course not. Does it mean it might be worthy of serious consideration? Does it mean this might be true under some circumstances? And if so, what? And should that be investigated? Answer, yeah. That's my view. So such people, they will recall wherever they are born. And when they die, they will be born in Sukhavati. Wherever they are born and wherever they dwell, they will never be separated from Adi Avalokiteshvara. I think that's a key right there. If you have so immersed your mind in this practice that you're never separated from Adi Avalokiteshvara, you have a sense of ongoing inseparability between your own identity, your own awareness, and that of Avalokiteshvara. That sounds like it's getting pretty serious pretty quickly. If this is recited constantly, one will be clear-minded, one's voice will be melodious, and one will become knowledgeable in all sacred literature. So about 10 minutes, probably now it's more like 15 years ago, out in Kham, there was one Geshe Geshe Acha, Yolupa. And he lived in a village, kind of nondescript little village out there in cowboy country of eastern Tibet. And he was known as being a really sweet Geshe, very sweet, very gentle, very pure soul. And he recited Om Mani Padme Hum an awful lot, and that's what people knew. I know this because a friend of mine, a Roman Catholic priest, went there to investigate reports of him having achieved rainbow body. And he went there and interviewed people in the village because they wrapped his, when he passed away, they wrapped his body in the outer, the namjar, the golden robe, the outer robe, the more ceremonial robe of a Buddhist monk. He was a very pure monk. They wrapped it, and then the people in that village reported, then it just evaporated in a rainbow light. And when they came back, it was just a robe and I think maybe hair and nails, kind of classic case. So he interviewed people who were there at the time. Seemed pretty credible. Didn't arouse a whole lot of interest in Tibet. I think for one reason, it's like, yeah, another one. Another one. I translated maybe 10 years ago for Kyabshe Benor Rinpoche, who at that time, of course, was the head, supreme head of the Nyingma order. I translated for him just once. I found it very difficult. He had a very strong, calm accent. I don't understand it very well. But I got by. He was giving a medicine Buddha empowerment in Los Angeles. And speaking maybe only 300 or 400 people in the audience. And he said, and I was translating for him, so I know what he said. He said, I know with certain knowledge that during my lifetime there have been at least 6 people in Tibet who have achieved rainbow body. Okay. Now, I listened to him saying that. And if I went down to the Kavli Institute of Theoretical Physics in Santa Barbara, which is really world-class, Stephen Hawking goes there, and Antein Seiling and so forth, and I heard David Gross, who I've met, he came to a conference that I organized, he was a Nobel laureate. If David Gross said something speaking on behalf of physics, I would accept it. This guy is world-class. And he was the director of a world-class Institute of Theoretical Physics. My listening to David Gross, my listening to Pierre Rinpoche, well, I'll put them more or less in the same category. They speak with enormous gravitas. Yeah? Except for I have greater confidence in Pierre Rinpoche. So when he says that, I will say, we know. We Buddhist community, we Tibetan Buddhists, we know that people are still achieving rainbow body on a regular basis. We know this. That doesn't mean that other people know that. It doesn't mean that Tibetans know whether the Higgs boson has been discovered, or people living in the Amazon Delta, whether H2O is the chemical constitution of... They don't know. But some communities know, and it's inference based on authority. Oh, and to finish the story, that Geshe who, judging by the people in his village, achieved rainbow body. And then this monk, Francis Tissot is his name, by the way, Francis Tissot, he wrote up his whole account, and it seemed quite legitimate. And what this monk was known for before he passed away? Reciting Om Mani Padme Hum a whole lot. That's what people saw. He was a hidden yogi. They just saw him reciting Om Mani Padme Hum a whole lot. And then where's Kathy? There's Kathy. One of the two principal disciples of Geshe Ngontaye. I think during his life he was not renowned, was he? The two, not renowned like world, like a Dzogchen Rinpoche or like, you know, not renowned. How many, and he's just one of the two principal close disciples of our teacher, Geshe Ngontaye. And when he passed away, how many days?
18.
18 days in the clear light of death. Mm-hmm. 18 days. Mm-hmm. You hear something like that, and that's public. That's public. That's really not open to question to intelligent people. That's not a rumor. It's what happened. That's where we get some confidence. This is still really happening. So maybe a final one. Sutra of Basket Weaving states, Buddha Dipavara said, if any son or daughter of good breeding recites this 6-syllable knowledge mantra, that person will be imbued with inexhaustible ability. Your aggregate of primordial wisdom will be purified. You will be endowed with great loving kindness and great compassion. Day by day, the 6 perfections will be completely perfected. In terms of your status, you will attain the state of a world emperor, not in this lifetime, don't hold your breath. You'll not fall back from the state of a bodhisattva. Okay, he's talking about total immersion here. He's not talking about magic. They just recite this 100,000 times, you become a bodhisattva. That's nonsense. So he's talking about something really deep here. He's talking about real immersion. You will be manifestly awakened in the state of unsurpassable, truly perfect enlightenment. Those who utter the six-syllable knowledge mantra and who constantly apply themselves to its recitation will be endowed with merit. Reciting this assembles as many Lord Buddhas as there are grains of sand in the Ganges. 10 million Tathagatas are present in each poor of that child of good breeding. Dwelling there, O child of good breeding, you attain such a wish-fulfilling jewel. Child of good breeding, it is good that your progeny will be liberated. Child of good breeding, even the organisms that live in your stomach will become irreversible bodhisattvas and they will offer their gratitude. So I think if this is to be meaningful, then he's talking about some very, very deep experience where this is the outer display. The outer display is doing what a tape recorder could do, making the noises. The inner display is, he's talking about very profound practice of Avalokiteshvara. Sutra again. Lord Shakyamuni said, lusting for another's wife and committing adultery, the act of killing, murdering one's father and mother, slaying an arhat, causing a bhikshuni to lose her ordination, I hate that one, destroying a stupa, destroying a temple, maliciously drawing blood from the body of a tathagata, and the obscurations of the acts of immediate retribution are all utterly purified with these six syllables of the Sutra of Basket Weaving. So again, we're talking about really the power of the Rigpa that is catalyzed, drawn forth with very, very deep faith, with samadhi, and with the mantra. I think that's what we're really talking about here. It's not mechanical, it's not numbers, it's not quantitative. Sonsen Gambo gave this advice to his minister of foreign affairs. This is the great king, first great Dharma king in Tibet. The pinnacle of the great compassionate one is found in the six syllables, Om Mani Padme Hum. It is these six syllables that purify obscurations for your own sake, and it is these six syllables that purify the abodes of the six states of existence for others' sake. It is these six syllables that give rise to the common cities in this life, and it is these six syllables that give rise to the supreme city of Mahamudra in the future. Recite these six syllables, Om Mani Padme Hum. Count them, actualize them, teach them, and explain them. This is the way followed by the Buddhas of the past. It is revealed by the Buddhas of the present, and it is the path of the Buddhas of the future. The people of Tibet gave this advice. This is the quintessential Dharma of the great compassionate one. There is nothing superior to Om Mani Padme Hum. This is the unmistaken essence for attaining supreme enlightenment. And the emanation king, the same one, he taught this essence, Om Mani Padme Hum, is a wish-fulfilling jewel. So all supreme and common cities arise from this, recite this, earnestly apply yourself to this. So thank you. Thank you, anonymous donor. So I don't tell everybody on the podcast who you are. But she's the really lady. Very good. So what I can say about mantra with confidence is that it's not a mechanical recitation. All we need to do, we don't need to look any further than Shantideva. If you recite mantras and other liturgies of the wandering mind, it's pointless. And Om Mani Padme Hum is no exception. So it's not that. It's not magic. It's not just nonsense. It's not mumbo jumbo. It's the outer crust. It is what manifesting public. And it's indicative. It's like an iceberg. You see the tip of the iceberg and that one 90% is down below. When it's coming from a deep space like that, now this is rooted in a coarse renunciation. It's rooted in samadhi. It's rooted in deep faith. It's rooted in deep purity of mind. And here's the outer display. When you've got 90% of the practice beneath the mantra, and it's manifesting by way of the mantra, you've got something really powerful in your hands. Now, how to take that? I think the best response. Otherwise, I would not read it out loud. I'm not going to embarrass somebody, not intentionally. No, I think it's the best response. But I know, Hosa, and I've told everybody. There's no problem, because there's no criticism here. Hosa's not a flaky person, kind of dilly-dallying around in Dharma and then going off and going to nightclubs. Or if she is, she's keeping it very secret. If you're a sincere practitioner, And you say, really? That's not the end of the conversation, that's the beginning of the conversation. You say, really? Really? If a scientist comes out with some extraordinary statement like, you know, Einstein's little paper in 1905 about special relativity, I think the scientist never read that before would say, really? They wouldn't say, he wasn't even famous, he was a third class patent clerk. He was like Dujum Lingba. I mean, what's lower than that? He couldn't even get a job in high school. He couldn't even get a job as a high school teacher, young Einstein. He was considering he might have to work for his dad. Couldn't get a job. And then finally, a friend of his arranged, because he had connections in Bern, to get him this third class patent clerk job. And in 1905, he changed all of physics. In his spare time, while he had, I think, two kids at the time, working full-time, and to raise a bit of money, he was giving tutorials. Back then, you could have a tutorial with Einstein. For probably just a few francs. And he wrote, 4 papers. But it was called The Miraculous Year. So where was that coming from? Ah, yeah, really? Here's this kind of nice-looking guy who's a third class. I mean, really, it's kind of like almost like he's an accountant. Really, it's not much different than he's an accountant and he's writing these papers. He submitted one of them, got his PhD from that. He wrote one of his papers written in 1 year. He submitted it and got a PhD for that. You know. Really? But then people started reading what he was writing and said, really? And then, of course, they read it more carefully. And then, of course, they started pursuing it more and more and more. And within 10 years, he had one of the most prestigious positions in physics on the planet. University of Berlin. It didn't get any higher than that. It was only about 10 years later. It rose up to the very top. And that's when he was working on general relativity theory. Really? So the open-minded person, if it's not even interesting, if it seems so far-fetched, you know, since I said, really, I think it's implausible. And that's it. That's fine. Then don't worry about it. It's not like you go to hell if you don't believe that. There's no threat here. But if you consider a Kamachamet, but he was a great Mahamudra master. He was renowned, he was respected in this peer-reviewed system by other incredible masters. Extraordinary erudition, deep insight, renowned 500 years after his, 400, 500 years after his death. Maybe it's worth checking out. Really? Then you check. And then you find out. But of course it's not just here. Oh, yeah. So, Om Mani Padme Hum. I think that one mantra had quite an impact on Tibetan culture for 1,000 years. I really do. You know, the intimacy, the sense of personal connection of a whole people, of Avalokiteshvara, very embodiment of compassion. Manifesting in not just one or two, but a number of their greatest lamas. Just feeling here as Avalokiteshvara embodied. And seeing these individuals. Seeing people like His Holiness Dalai Lama, Gyawakamapa. Seeing these others through history. As a culture could say, we know. We know. That doesn't mean the Burmese know. It doesn't mean that the Vietnamese know. But within that context, like I can say, yes, I know the atomic constitution of water, H2O. Yeah, I know that, yeah. Because that's my community. That was their community. So now we don't have to choose. We can be cross-community. We can fish in two streams and pull out wish-fulfilling jewels from both. So good. So enjoy your day off, your day on.